Welcome to the Merlin Podcast, bringing Europe's fresh waters back to life.
In March 2026, four European Horizon research projects came together in Brussels to take stock of what they've achieved and what comes next. Merlin, Waterlands, Spongescapes and Spongeworks, projects that between them have coordinated freshwater restoration work at 71 sites across the continent, gathered with EU and national policymakers, agencies, NGOs and scientists to ask a deceptively tricky question. Why does transformative, large-scale ecological restoration remain so stubbornly difficult to achieve? And what would it actually take to make it happen everywhere? The event was titled Freshwater, Wetlands and Sponge Landscapes for a Resilient Europe. The title itself signals something of a shift in how this field has come to understand its own task. It's not only about rivers and streams anymore, as important as those are. Instead, it's about entire landscapes, the peatlands that hold water like a sponge and release it slowly, the floodplains that buffer floods and store carbon, the wetlands that filter water and harbour biodiversity. The idea of the sponge landscape, a catchment designed to absorb, retain and slowly release water rather than shed it as fast as possible, has become one of the more powerful concepts in European climate adaptation thinking. With extreme rainfall events and prolonged droughts becoming more frequent and more severe, restoring the natural water retention function of landscapes is no longer just an ecological ambition, it's a practical necessity. The morning session of the Brussels event showcased what the projects had actually achieved. The restored rivers, the re-wetted peatlands, the tools and frameworks and financing guides that 4 years of research and fieldwork had produced. But the afternoon turned to a knotty question. What does it take to move from demonstration to transformation? From a handful of flagship restoration sites to the kind of systemic, continent-wide change that the Nature Restoration Regulation, now EU law, actually demands. The panel discussion on restoration upscaling brought together some of the people best placed to address that question. Ellis Penning from Deltares in the Netherlands, who's coordinating the Spongescapes project and has spent years working at the interface of freshwater science and policy, moderated. She was joined by Anders Iversen from the DG Environment and Willem Jan-Goosen from the DG Climate Action at the European Commission. She was also joined by Craig Bullock, coordinator of the Waterlands project, who brought the perspective of large-scale wetland and peatland restoration, and by Sebastian Berg, coordinator of Merlin, who had just spent 4 years overseeing restoration work across 18 case studies in very different ecological, cultural and institutional contexts across Europe. What followed was a candid and reflective conversation about the future of ecological restoration in Europe, moving from policy targets to governance failures, from financial barriers to the challenge of changing the values and literacy of society, and from translating the ambition of the Nature Restoration Regulation into reality. Here's Ellis to kick off the discussion.
So I will start with a few questions prepared to start off the discussion today. In this panel, we're talking about how do we upscale restoration? How do we implement sponge landscapes? And at scale, that is, right? So going from one single measure to a wider set, making the whole water cycle function again. So I would like to start with Anders Iversen from DG Environment. Very nice that you're here. And just to start off with this, have we already heard about the Nature Restoration Regulation, and it has been adopted in 2024, and then the European Water Resilience Strategy came along in 2025. So can you explain a bit to our audience here in how you see that that has helped to strengthen this upscaling?
I would take the opportunity also to go a bit back when we talk about the legal and policy context, to remind everyone that the Water Framework Directive that we've had for more than 25 years now actually also mentions that it's meant to improve also the terrestrial ecosystems and wetlands directly depending on the aquatic elements and contribute to mitigating the effects of floods and droughts. Maybe we haven't been the best at going outside of the aquatic elements and into the rest of the catchments in the implementation of the Water Framework Directive. But in the recommendations that the Commission made to all member states last year, we said that they need to boost effects on nature-based solutions, including renaturalization and ecosystem restoration. And that was the recommendations for the next cycle of the Water Framework Directive, connect the green and the blue water better. And then, of course, everybody knows we got the biodiversity strategy, which introduced free-flowing rivers and the nature restoration regulation, which also focuses not only on free-flowing rivers, but also on the functions of the floodplains. So the newest element, of course, is the water resilience strategy, which talks quite a lot about the need to redress the natural sponge function of landscapes. It talks about sponge cities, and that water management should prioritize nature-based solutions. So I think with even if the water resilience strategy is just a policy document, it will also help giving a push to the nature restoration regulation and the Water Framework Directive implementation. Thank you.
Thank you, Anders. And just to complement on that, Willem-Jan, you're also from DG Environment. I know you've been very much involved in sponge landscapes in the last few years as well. Can you tell me a bit more about how you see that, like the role of climate adaptation or the part of talking about climate adaptation, how it's linked to ecosystem restoration and how you see that we can benefit from the synergies between these?
Yeah, thank you. And I'm from DG Climate Action, but
that's
fine. Okay, that's okay, because we work very close together within the Commission, especially with DG Environment. Now, I think, suppose we wouldn't have any climate change, which would have been great, then I think already restoring the sponge function would have a lot of arguments to do it. I think we are all experts here, so that doesn't need any argumentation there. But we have climate change. And regrettably, exactly on the water elements, because climate change and the water cycle are so closely related, indeed we see it already, and we are about nearly 1.5 degrees warming, we already see quite a lot of impact on indeed intensive rainfall and droughts and extended droughts, but all kinds of impacts on the water system, on the biodiversity, etc. That's why we are so interested in restoring the sponge function, or we even describe it as climate resilient landscapes, that we want to, at landscape level, so at a really at large level, that you start preparing for the present climate impacts, but even more for the future climate impacts. And I think if you really start realizing what's ahead of us, I think that it might be one of the strongest arguments to start acting on this.
Yeah, I think indeed also the cost of inaction can be quite high, right?
Yes, indeed. It is what I always like, maybe being an ecologist myself, but I mean, if you really dive into restoring ecosystems and how they can help to deliver ecosystem services and dealing with droughts and floods, but also with the spread of diseases, etc., sea level rise, of course, then it goes without saying that nature-based solutions or upscaling and nature restoration is something which needs to be done. But of course, there's a lot of complexity there. And maybe one additional argument, which I think was addressed in the presentations this afternoon, is the carbon sequestration part of it as well. And so if we're talking about climate resilient landscapes, it's also especially that part I think, which is also very interesting. And so the combination of climate mitigation and adaptation, but water and biodiversity, it all comes together, I think, in this approach.
Yeah, and that kind of links a bit to also what Craig, what you've been saying before, that some of the work in waterlands, it has also been very much focused on how do you reduce greenhouse gas emissions, how do you reduce nutrients leaching into the environment. So can you tell a bit more about, like, from your perspective, especially with the focus on the wetland part? We see that some of the projects that we are discussing are also looking at, for example, the urban domain or at agricultural domain. But from the wetlands perspective, what makes effective restoration? Where do you have to go? When do you have it at scale? Then you make it effective.
Well, I suppose you could have restoration at all scales, really. But if you really want to make a difference, it has to be at large scale, I suppose. And a lot of the nature-based solutions I've been talking about, whether it be carbon storage, keeping the carbon in the ground, in peatlands, for example, whether it's controlling the water levels, keeping the water in situ for as long as possible, so you risk those downstream flooding events so that you maintain the quality and the storage of the water. I mean, these are all things you could potentially do at quite small scales, but obviously there's a cumulative benefit if you can do it at large scale. I mean, to achieve real reductions in carbon, say if you get a peatland to a pristine or back to close to a pristine condition, and it starts to sequester carbon from the atmosphere, you're only really going to make that huge difference if you have a huge area of land. But fortunately, we do have huge areas of land. We do have huge areas which are given over to peatlands. The unfortunate thing is that they're so degraded. So the opportunity is there. They're definitely there. And there needs to be a lot more joined up thinking, I think, from governance levels. Governance, local government, national government has to realize the benefits of that. And they need to coordinate together to realize those benefits. So there's plenty of opportunities there, honestly. Yes.
Thank you, yeah. And then Sebastian, and not only talking about the wetlands, but also going beyond that to the different, you had 18 cases in Merlin, which is a large amount and really spread over Europe, which I think is also interesting to see those differences, yeah? And to see the local cultural differences that also have an impact on what's being done. So if you say that your experience from those 18 cases, how would you say, what's the next step? How do we need to go forward in upscaling that restoration?
Yeah, thanks, Alice. Indeed, it was quite a privilege to overview the activities done across 18 cases in Europe, with all the differences that they encountered and had to tackle. And one element, one aspect I realized was that there was quite often a plan B been pursued because plan A had to be changed from what was originally planned. And against this background, we also need to understand if we have an ideal of having like whole catchments sponge proven, it may take a while to get there, because right now opportunism and hurdles every now and then are still pretty high. But what we learned from looking onto these 18 cases is that there are two dimensions that really make upscaling progress. On the one hand, we need reliable financing, and on the other hand, it's supportive governance. And both elements really bring long-term commitment to the case, and this is beyond what Daniel was calling projectification. So it's not about 4.5 years. It's another 4.5 years and another and another. So it's really something to be viewed upon in the mid to long run. So if we have these two dimensions, established reliable financing and supportive governance, then comes stakeholder engagement with it. But that is because there is long-term commitment, and then you can deal and tackle with the stakeholders. And it's about learning about failures, about successes, and not to have this continuous learning after one project and then, you know, you lose the lessons. And this is also related to long-term commitment, that you have some learning included and, evidence monitoring and then adaptive management related to that. But it's not to be like, you can establish it within a single project, but the challenge is to continue it over various projects.
Yeah, and it's a bit of a stepping stone, right, from one project into the next one as well, just to ensure that you keep the momentum going. Hey, I also would like to invite you all here sitting in the room to ask your questions and to come forward and join us on one of the empty chairs to also put your... I see Thomas is already wanting to ask a question to the panelists here. So just come forward, please. And just, if you want to, please also come forward for the next questions.
The first question came from Tomasz Okruszko, professor at the Warsaw University of Life Sciences.
Assuming there are no constraints, yes, a bit of miracle, on restoration, on upscaling, what should be the upper limit, or can we set the upper limit on our upscaling on restoration in Europe?
Just at the moment, legally, in the nature restoration regulation, it's 25,000 kilometers of rivers that should be turned back into free flowing. And then I think for the other habitat types, you have other percentages of what is not in good status now that need to be restored by 2030, 2040, and 2050.
I think also we need proper targeting. You know, we have to identify those places which will provide the maximum returns, both to natural environments, especially in terms of the ecology, but also in terms of the human needs as well. So we need something of a cost-benefit analysis, I think, to identify the areas that we should work on first. You're right, the nature restoration law certainly provides some targets that we have to reach. But also, as well as the large-scale upscaling of any one habitat, it's very important that that upscaling is integrated into the protection improvement of other types of habitats as well. So it's no use having, for instance, the water flowing more slowly from a restored peatland if the rivers that you have downstream have all been canalized and, you know, you don't have those gains. So there has to be that integrated thinking at a landscape scale rather than just looking at one individual habitat.
I think it will be very interesting to see the draft national restoration plans, because then each member state will have made an assessment of what to do, how far they can go, where they need it. So hopefully they have made these choices. Where do they want to prioritize?
Yeah, and maybe it's because from climate perspective, we are trained to have a long-term perspective. And from there, I think your question maybe is the easy part. I think, and especially with all the people here in the room, I can rather easily draw how a landscape ideally should look like, and then why not stay as close as possible to that ideal landscape. So that's the easy part, I'm afraid, but it's very important to have this vision where you are going to. And but then, of course, the more difficult part comes in. You have landowners, you have people from who, it's very realistic, they have economic concerns already in the short term, so we have to address that. But maybe very briefly, I was yesterday in a civil dialogue group of agriculture with a lot of NGOs, and I was really impressed of how almost all NGOs from all kinds of agriculture, they know that climate change is already have an impact and what's ahead of them. So they're very worried. And actually a lot of them are very open to think, how can we change land use, how we can change agriculture. But also, for example, that you see now often that a lot of agriculture people look at their own land plot. Well, they recognize that if upstream someone doesn't work together and they are still draining, it doesn't help them. So, but this takes time. And maybe that's, for me, a big compliment to Merlin. So many aspects which are important you worked on. They're all building blocks, but the big challenge is, of course, how to start implementing them.
The next question came from Harriet Bulkley, professor at Durham University and leader of the Naturevation Project.
But my question to you is one which relates to the IPBES report, which was published last year. Some of you will know it, I'm sure, very closely, which looked at how we can achieve transformative change for nature and climate, particularly, of course, in relationship to biodiversity. Their conclusions are that transformative change can only be achieved through a mosaic of approaches. That's the most likely pathway, because the kinds of governance and finance that you would all love to see don't exist. So I'm wondering what that means for your theories of change. Is projectification basically all that we have?
projectification is where the action is ongoing. And what we saw also from the Merlin experience is that such projects, they chime in into different contexts. So there are some initiatives that are fueled by a project and then another project and maybe a couple of years no project and then there is another project. And again, if the context is not providing the embedding of where the action is happening, then we lose the potential for transformation. That is clear. Sometimes I'm struggling knowing that Merlin already included the top of the pops when it comes to the case studies. I'm wondering how is the ordinary landscape looking like, and I'm afraid that this is really the issue. That you fuel actions and activities for a couple of years and then there's no more money and then transformation is slowing down or comes to a halt. I don't have a good answer to that, also from knowing from the perspective that I'm in and being a freshwater ecologist, but it is about public commitment, I suppose, and that is ultimately taxpayers' money being invested into such things.
Transformational change. People are banding around that word quite a lot, haven't they? Transformational changes are really difficult, you know, how to bring that about. I suppose where we really need to see it is in government institutions, both at all levels of government, between government departments. Every time everyone looks at barriers to restoration, you inevitably very quickly bump into all these institutional barriers with government departments who don't talk to one another, government departments where one personality is very, very strong and influential, blah, blah. It goes on and on. Then you have local conditions for all the local planning situations and rivalries between small towns and the capital. Bringing transformational change is most needed at a government level. And I think we've encountered those problems when we've been looking at some of the nature-based solutions, because we can see the solutions, but we still need to convince the civil engineers or one of the planning departments to realize that there are real benefits there, and the benefits also in terms of resourcing as well. So, yeah, we have a lot of focus on ecological restoration, and that's great, but we know a lot of that stuff now. We really, for me, still in this project, understanding governance is still a challenge.
No, I was thinking, if I look at all the policy documents which have been published over the last 6, 7, 8 years, at least from European level, I mean, the number of times nature-based solutions is mentioned explicitly, and I think also in the research domain, the Horizon Europe Project, LIFE, etc. I mean, it's quite impressive. It's even more how to keep track of all the results. So that's the good part. Of course, the challenging part is, and I think one of the reports which really I think also was very helpful was the Environmental European Investment Bank report, which clearly showed like, look, and it's also mapped that there is a lot of policy intentions, but it doesn't take off. And I think then we are entering an area of complexity where maybe it's also to realize that not only from ecological arguments you can start this change. So you need so many actors, and then it's getting complex because how to use it. Just another example, we know from the Common Agricultural Policy that in principle for again, agricultural people, there is financial support for this, but most member states don't use it. And a warning, this is going to be even more in the next MFF. Yeah, because, so maybe one of the lessons is, it's great to go to Brussels, but maybe it's even the capitals where in the next years, the big decisions are going to be made. And then the last thing is, and that's a complexity thing, how to make sure that it looks like the basis is there. So it's, and there are scientists out there who knows a lot about transition. So what is needed to make to scale it up? And maybe one of them is maybe getting the financial world more involved.
The next question was from Kirsty Blackstock from the James Hutton Institute, who worked on engaging economic sectors with freshwater restoration in Merlin.
We recognise that you need a combination of activities. We've heard about strengthening and enforcing regulation, the financing, but also I want to go back to learning. And one of our stepping stones or our pillars was around values, attitudes and behaviours, because really to get deep change, we need to really think about how people understand and think about our natural ecosystem functions. And I think there, this is not just a kind of nice to have, it's really fundamental. And I wondered about the panel's view on different ideas of literacy, because we heard today that if we want to find the money, it's not just in an environmental silo, it's from the agricultural work with farmers, it's from the climate silo. You know, we need to bring them together. So we need to get better at understanding each other's framings and language. So do we need to help people have more water literacy, climate literacy, ecological literacy, agricultural literacy? We understand each other's language. We see how each other sees the world. I think this is part of our transformation. But what do you think?
Well, yeah, I think it's very much a communication issue now, because we have these great pilot examples, best practices. We have the knowledge, but we have to convince also the local politicians, the developers, to trust these new solutions, because there is a lot of trust and tradition in the grey solutions, and there is not really confidence across the board in these new solutions. So I think we need to work on documentation and monitoring, but we really have to be able to communicate it to those who make the decisions on land use, on what solutions to take for flood prevention or stormwater handling. There are enough policy signals, and we need to communicate the solutions, create trust in that, but then these levels also need the skills and the know-how. Because it doesn't help if you want to do a nature-based solution if the municipality doesn't have the people who know how to do it. And that can even be the machine operators who might be used to destroying a river, and they have to learn how to build a restored river, which is something completely different.
It sounds as if we are seeking to educate the people. And I wonder whether this is the approach. Well, it might be part of the approach, but you were talking about return on investment, for instance, and I'm wondering whether we are using concepts that do not fit together logically, and that we are always trying to, in our Sunday speeches, bring it on the table and say, yes, every euro invested means 18 euros back and all these things, which sounds so great. And of course, everybody will say, yeah, let's do that. But it's not really materializing this way. And therefore, I guess we need to be super careful to, we are always talking about things everybody can agree to, because saving the environment, doing restoration. You know, when I talk to my people, to my friends, I tell them I help restoring nature, and they say, oh, you're a good guy. And still, you know, things do not change. And maybe it's also that our approach to this is the issue, that we really try to bring, like, what is it, round hole, square picks, kind of that it doesn't fit together, and we try to force things together that are not naturally joining.
I think in our Waterlands project, we've done quite a lot of work in terms of deliberation, listening to people, and in the co-creation element as well. So we put a great deal of emphasis on listening to what people understand about the environment, what their existing knowledge is, what their values are, and how that those values inform their thinking. And it's a hard-drawn process, but it's very important to just really start at the bottom and find out what people think already and how they interpret things, and then to slowly, hopefully, bring them around to your own ideas, you know, if you can. So it's a challenging operation, but I think it's absolutely essential. I do worry a little bit that there's always this segment in society who you won't be able to reach. You know, the people who aren't reading the right newspapers, the people who aren't going to turn up to the focus group meetings or the workshops. Just maybe one solution to that is having some examples where it could be a project-based solutions. Some examples which have really worked. Because it's great then when you can demonstrate to people that maybe their fears, maybe their anxieties in relation to re-wetting or something like that actually worked and didn't have any of these calamitous outcomes that maybe some quarters would have predicted. So there may be some benefits even in small scale projects as well as the large scale ones that we're hoping to promote.
Yeah, it's also a bit of peer-to-peer learning, right? And that might be also in different type of stakeholder groups, you learn in different manners. And that is also something to take into account.
The next question came from Yulia Bovarov from the Nature Conservancy.
And we've been hearing this great developments in policy around the nature restoration regulation and the freshwater target that's there. But I also really think it is important to mention that the Commission has renounced the reopening of the Water Framework Directive. There's going to be a planned revisioning. And it has not really been mentioned today yet, so I thought this was a good opportunity to do that. And I think many civil society organizations are worried about this development. I've heard many other citizens are also really worried about this. So I wanted to take this opportunity to address it and just ask the Commission representatives and maybe other panelists what their views are on this. What are possible risks or opportunities? We know it's coming from the pressure from mining industry. And I'm curious to see what is at stake here. How do we feel? Because on the one hand, the Commission is stating very much the importance of freshwater ecosystems. But then on the other hand, this doesn't really signal so much the importance and protection and restoration of freshwater ecosystems. So I'm curious about this.
I don't think I can say that much, except for the process, that there will be a call for evidence later this month. Published, and then the Commission will receive a lot of input, and based on summarizing that, it will decide what direction this revision will take, and of course that will be decided at other levels than the unit I'm working in.
Claire McCampbell from Wetlands International asked the next question.
For me, where I see transformative change happening in a policy landscape is for Denmark and the tripartite agreement. So this is a government deciding we've got to get serious about addressing agricultural and land use issues. So this is the government saying, okay, this is the direction we're going to go. It's taking X number of hectares of land out of production for wetland and for forest restoration. And not surprisingly, Denmark are one of the best actually then mobilising the cap towards deliver that. And they're pushing at the barriers of what we can use public financing for. This then draws in private finance. Novo Nordisk is one of the biggest, the foundation is one of the other private contributors towards upscaling this intervention. So that's one example of where we see a transformative change. This is a kind of once in a lifetime realization that they need to adjust their agricultural production. And another interesting example comes from closer to home, and it's in Flanders. And they have adopted the sponge targets in policy, because this happened after floods a few years ago, and they even have a minister who's called SpongeBob in the cabinet. Now, that minister is not a coincidence, but he's responsible for floods, and he's responsible for the agriculture budget. So he's got the problem, and he also has the ability to do something about it. So, and then there's also a bit of shock doctrine. You need to be willing to go for this new change when there's a flood that happens, and then you roll it out. So I think there's learning that we can take from those. Those are two examples. I'm sure there may be more, and yes, everything's not perfect with either of them. But this, when we're talking about transformative change, it really does have to be about, I think, governments signalling a clear direction of travel. And we don't have that for sponge landscapes or water restoration yet. But I think this is something that we can think along, and I would ask everybody here to think about, okay, we're working on a project, but how am I communicating this to the people that actually hold the pen and are writing at this moment in time the nature restoration plans, who are trying to work out what on earth they should be doing under the simplified cap. So there are people writing these plans now. Are you going to them and saying, can we do this measure here in these types of landscapes to deliver this? This is the moment at which to be engaging. Well, it was also the moment 2 years ago. But like, these plans are being written. If there is nobody engaging with them saying, this is what we need to do now, it will not happen. And it won't happen just by producing a document. There needs to be engagement with government ministries sitting down and saying, can you do this here, 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 and here? They may not be receptive to it, but I think it still has to be done.
I think the two examples you mentioned from Denmark and Flanders also exemplify that we have to break down these silos between water management planning and land use planning, and we have to start planning the whole catchment, connect the green water retained in the landscape with the blue water.
That's a very important point that you are raising. And just talking from the Merlin perspective, as we really produce a lot of material that can be helpful, it is now, of course, no longer under the Merlin umbrella because the project comes to an end, but the expertise that we have developed is also radiating into the national channels for sure, because, the Merlin colleagues, they are well established also within their national circles. And this is currently happening, also promoting Merlin tools like the one that Annette Bartow-Pedersen was presenting to us today. So yes, it is happening. The question is, how successful is it? Is it happening?
Eva Hernandez from Wetlands International, and latterly Merlin and WWF, asked the final question to the panel.
I wanted to go back to the Water Framework Directive because we have been talking about financing nature. Claire mentioned the river basin plans, which is the landscape approach. And we know we need money to come into the landscapes to restore them. We have been talking to sectors, and there's this transformation work that we did in Merlin. And all the sectors say, okay, nature-based solutions, that's a public good. It should be the government's paying for it, no? So, okay, let's have the governments pay, but let's recover the polluter-based principle that it's in the Water Framework Directive and that we forgot so much about it. And maybe it's not the best moment to talk about it, but it's there, and it could be another tool that works in this Water Framework Directive. I don't know if you have any thoughts of, can we bring it back to life?
Yeah, I mean, of course, the Water Framework Directive is on it, but a general reflection is that I think the land use is a key point. It was also mentioned before. And indeed, I still nowadays still, and I'm from a water management authority as well, seconded, but you see that often water management tend to look at the surface water. I think you rightly so mentioned the groundwater, which is often forgotten, and then of course the land use. So I think this integrated approach you are describing in sponsorship and sponsor work is key. And there's still a lot to be done in the transition. And I'm saying the great of Merlin is that a lot of technical details, which often were brought forward, like we are not sure that we can make progress because there are a lot of technical questions to be tackled. I think after Merlin and all the other projects, that cannot be an argument anymore. But at the same time, it's hard work to communicate and convince everyone what is the vision and what is the solution. How can nature-based, talking about a sponge landscape or a climate-resilient landscape, I think that is a key element because that is a vision where you want to move towards. And then I think a lot of technical questions, they can be tackled, like what are the type of measures? And then you can provide in that area, these are the type of measures. And if you question, how do we involve stakeholders? Then you just take from the shelf, these are ways you can tackle stakeholders. What about finance? So all those questions which often are brought on the table, like issues you first need to tackle, I think all the information is there. And why I'm saying this is that I can understand you say maybe governments should start rethinking how they finance their water management or their landscape measures, which is a fair point. But I would say don't wait for that, because we need to act, I think, the next tomorrow and the next week and the next year. And then I like to repeat that if you connect with people out there who are experiencing themselves that the impacts of climate change are already there, they are highly motivated. So it's more that how to bring the vision that having a climate resilient landscape or a response landscape, that might help them, and how it might help them. And I think then that is the basis for the transition. And maybe the last point, what I learned from both Flanders and Denmark, is that from Denmark I learned from people working closely to that, they were for 10 years, they have been repeatedly saying again and again, it's not fair that for climate mitigation, agriculture is left out. Yeah, so, and that took many years of communication. At a certain point, people said, you know, indeed, it's true. But there are many member states where agriculture is still left out for climate mitigation measures. And if you say, no, you have to take your fair part of it, then all of a sudden carbon sequestration comes in, and then all of a sudden the landscape approach pops up. And the same is for Flanders. Flanders doesn't have any big river to take fresh water from. So they are, the worldwide number two or three water scarce country, because there's so many people and they have hardly any fresh water. So that is why they are really interested in the response. So facts on the table and then a vision, I think that might help.
All right, thank you very much. We can continue talking for quite a bit, but we'll leave that to the next panel. I would like to thank all of you here today with us, and then we'll move on.
What you've just heard is a conversation that ranges beyond the usual boundaries of an environmental policy panel. There were moments of real honesty here about what EU legislation has and hasn't delivered, about the frustrations of projectification, about the gap between policies that people in a Brussels conference room agree are important, and the realities of what happens when those policies meet a local planning department or municipal engineers who have long-standing ways of doing things. A few themes stand out. Sebastian Berck's observation, drawn from Merlin's 18 case studies, that upscaling restoration ultimately requires two things above all else: reliable financing and supportive governance, and that without both, you can't build the long-term commitment that transformation actually requires. Craig Bullock's point that even large-scale ambitions only work when they're integrated across habitat types. Anders Iversen's reminder that the Water Framework Directive, now 25 years old, was always meant to reach beyond the water's edge into the catchment, and that the Water Resilience Strategy offers a new opportunity to make that ambition real. And running through the entire conversation, the insight offered by Kirsty Blackstock, that deep change requires not just better policy and better financing, but a shift in how people understand and value the natural systems they live within. You'll hear more from Ellis Penning in the next and final episode of the Merlin podcast. We'll be heading outside to the banks of restored streams in the Scheldt catchment in Belgium, where Ellis and Sebastian Berck will walk us through what 4 years of work in Merlin has looked like, from the policy room to the riverbank, from the language of directives and upscaling targets to the sound of water moving through a landscape that is slowly finding its way back. That's in the final episode of the Merlin podcast, coming very soon. You can explore the Merlin Project website at project-merlin.eu. And you can keep up with progress on social media and at freshwaterblog.net. The Merlin Project is funded by the European Commission's Horizon 2020 programme. This podcast was presented and produced by me, Rob St. John. And the theme music is by project coordinator Sebastian Berck's band, Scala. The background music is by Scott Buckley. Please do like, share and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And until next time, thanks for tuning in.